and welcome to Greatest Britons. Today's date is Friday the 30th of October 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's episode of Greatest Britons is the second one on the mathematician and eugenicist Carl Pearson, and my co-host for today is, of course, Max Musson from Western Spring. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Britons then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, we're going to be talking again about Carl Pearson, and this is our third episode on Carl Pearson. We'll start with a brief recap from last week. Last week we were talking about eugenics and how what we learn in life is not transmitted on through our genes. Although certain drives, such as the one that enables us to create civilization, looks like it does. And I say that because we've had the rise and fall of civilizations over the years. And even when we took our lowest people, the people that were our lowest classes, the criminal classes, and we sent them over to Australia, they were able to build a civilization over there. So it seems to me that white people have this ability to create civilization, and we don't actually have to be taught that. It's just something we do. We try to tame the nature around us. We try to bend it to our will, and we're actually successful at doing that, whereas other peoples may be just content to live with the environment that they have around them, if you look at sort of tribes in South America and places like that, whereas white people are always looking for something more. And I think that doesn't just come from the education, that comes from something that is deep within us, and I think that is that's transmitted on, that's inheritable, whereas what we actually learn is not inheritable. And we'll learn a little bit today about how Pearson explained how civilization is produced. But is there anything else you want to add to what I was saying there, Max?
Well, Carl Pearson did mention, in reference to the point you just made, he did mention about how, as far as South Africa was concerned, that the Khoisan and the Bantus had basically all of South Africa and more to themselves for several millennia, at least, probably tens of millennia, and didn't manage to provide to create a single civilization as a result of their sort of intertribal strife and constant wars with each other, etc. And as we all know, white settlers went out to South Africa, the Boers and the English and the British, I should say, and South Africa very quickly became the technological centre of all of sub-Saharan Africa, and became a nation that had, I think actually the South Africans even had their own independent nuclear deterrent as well, didn't they?
Yes, they did. They did.
So they'll be the only African country that's ever done that, and they also produced their own cars and had extensive manufacturing capability. I think they even produced their own aircraft as well, and that's in stark contrast to any of the African countries.
And it's not like they didn't educate the Africans in how to do these things, and they were able to maintain these things. But as far as innovating and continuing it, it doesn't look like they're having much success at that. I mean, the country is requiring food aid. It's got power cuts. The hospitals can't maintain themselves. The air force that can't maintain itself. They've had all sorts of problems over there since they've had black rule, and it's not for the want of trying from the West. I mean, the West is continually trying to help, but basically we see the proof of this, that there are differences between the races, there are differences in things that people pass on, in things that people inherit and things that people don't inherit. And until we face up to that, we're going to continue seeing these sorts of problems happening in the world, I think. Well, getting into Pearson's explanation of how civilization is produced, he said, "History shows me one way, and one way only, in which a high state of civilization has been produced, namely, the struggle of race with race, and the survival of the physically and mentally fitter race. If you want to know whether the lower races of man can evolve a higher type, I fear the only course is to leave them to fight it out amongst themselves. And even then, the struggle for existence between individual and individual, between tribe and tribe, may not be supported by that physical selection due to a particular climate on which probably so much of the Aryans' success depended. Now, here he describes the other races as the lower races of man, and this is where this scientific racism comes in. Because why is he describing them as lower races of man? Why does he think there are higher races of man? There are just different races. And what he's talking about here are the races that you were referring to there, Max, the Khoi and the San, and other races that don't have a tradition of being able to build a civilization. And what he is wondering there is, if they were to fight amongst themselves, as we said last week, it's the act of trying to defend your nation against another that spurs on technological progress and scientific progress. We end up devoting so much money to the military. I mean, even the airplanes that we talk about now and the importance of the airport, that was set up as a defensive mechanism. So you could drop bombs from the sky. So much of our technology comes from war, which is basically the struggle between one ethnicity and another ethnicity, or one race with another race, which is what he says here. And through that struggle, you get the improvement of the technology, and you end up with civilization. What are you saying here about it may not be supported by physical selection due to a particular climate on which probably so much of the Aryans' success depended? I'm not sure there whether maybe he's thinking that Aryans only existed in the cold countries, because Aryans have existed and colonized all over the world and have done for thousands of years. So perhaps he's talking about the fact that in places like Africa, they have too much of a temperate climate. Maybe it's too easy for this to happen. What do you think he means here, Max?
Yeah, I think what he's referring to there is the fact that the emergence of anatomically modern European peoples, the Cro-Magnon people, as they're very often called, came about during the heights of the last Great Ice Age, when, as far as Europe is concerned, about sort of 50% of Europe was covered under an ice sheet that was about 2 miles thick, and where there was the most inhospitable climate raging throughout the southern parts of Europe. There is a fairly general belief amongst anthropologists, and there has been really since the early part of the last century, the belief that those really harsh conditions created the evolutionary pressure that resulted in increased intelligence and increased innovation, and the amongst Europeans, and because effectively people were forced into learning how to make clothing, because if you couldn't make clothing, then you would just freeze to death. People had to learn to memorize the seasons, because unless they could memorize the seasons, they wouldn't know where the reindeer were going to be at a certain time in a year, so they wouldn't know where to go to hunt them. They wouldn't know where the bison were going to be. They wouldn't know where the mammoths were going to be. And of course, they needed to know where these creatures were at particular times of the year, so that they could hunt them in order to feed their families, so they didn't starve to death. And so it was forced upon the peoples of Europe in those days to carry in their head a memory of the years that have gone by, and a memory of the land over which they travelled. And there's evidence that they very often had to travel over vast expanses of the tundra that existed in order to locate their prey animals, and so they would have to be able to remember the landscape, so that they could recognise where they were, and as I say, they would have to be able to remember what time of year, and so that forced them to create a calendar, for example. And so, and there have been some bone artifacts that have been found that have got cuts in them, which archaeologists believe represent the sort of ticking off of days, or the sort of charting of days in nicks along the side of the bone so that they would be able to keep track of where they were in any particular month of the year or any particular season. And so there are rudimentary letters that have been found carved into some bones in some of the Cro-Magnon encampments that have been excavated in the southern parts of Russia, where there are what are regarded as alphabeti forms. They're not quite the letters that we use in our alphabet, but they are symbols that are obviously strung together to create some kind of a message or to record something. Not the symbols that we use today for our alphabet or the symbols that we use today for our system of numeracy, but symbols nonetheless that which can only have been used in order to record something.
I tend to take the opposite view there. I tend to think that we had to have a certain proficiency before you could even go into places like the tundra. You know, we had to have technological advancement. We had to understand about navigation. We had to understand about clothing. We had to understand about fire. We had to have metalworking. And I think we did all of that in the Fertile Crescent, where the first civilization sprung up. And then we headed off looking for resources, particularly tin, and the largest deposit of tin was in Cornwall, and we had to have had that tin from Cornwall to take it to the Fertile Crescent for the Bronze Age to take off in the Fertile Crescent. So I tend to believe that we had to have a certain standard before we could end up going into these cold countries. And with the rate of population replacement that we see now, for instance, if you just think in the last 70 years, 20% of the people that already live here have been replaced by another people, and within another 40 years it's going to be 60% of the population here now will have been replaced by another people. So within 100 years the majority of the people that will be here will be a different people to the people that were here 100 years ago. So when they find evidence of things like antlers with what appears to be writing on them, there's nothing to say they were our ancestors. They were probably the people that were here in Europe before we came here, because there are population movements all the time. And you think about it, you move to a new area, you dig into the ground there and you find a body, it's not going to be one of your familial ancestors, is it? Because you've only just moved into the area. And as you said, Max, we're moving about all the time, you know, moving across the tundra. So I tend to take the opposite view, but go on.
Well, the ice sheets weren't a static thing, you see. The ice sheets advanced and retreated all the time, just as they do today. And during periods when the ice sheets retreated, that then created a slightly warmer climate, which would then enable the Proto-Europeans to advance into Europe. And then as the ice sheets advanced again, then they would be forced back out again. But the climate in the Middle East, and you're referring to the Fertile Crescent, during the height of the last ice age, the climate there was a cool temperate climate with fir trees and bears and wild boar, all the same sort of animals that you would find in Northern Europe today. So effectively what you had was just an extended period where the climatic zones that exist across the Arctic and Northern Europe and Northern Asia today just migrated south as the ice sheets advanced and then retreated north again. And the warmer climates, so there would have been some interaction, I'm sure, between the people who were living in the cool temperate parts and the people who were living on the tundra. And there would have been some interaction between the people who lived in the warmer parts as well as those that with those that were living in the cool temperate parts. So and it would have all been as a result of the constant advance and then retreat of the ice sheets. And so I wouldn't say that what I said is wrong. What I would say is that some of what you have said would be true as well, that if our ancestors had exited Africa, for example, and had just gone naked into frozen tundra, then of course they wouldn't have survived, they would have died. But if they were living in a cool temperate area where there was cold, snowy winters, then yes, they would have learned to make clothes. They wouldn't necessarily have just died out straight away. And from the point of view of knowing whether these people are our ancestors or not, then there is a genetic, the genome for Cro-Magnon specimens have established that they are predominantly a very, very similar genetic type to modern day Europeans, and the genetic sequencing of modern day people have shown that there is still some Neanderthal DNA within the European peoples of today as well. So it wasn't so much a matter of the people that were first to meet the ice sheets being completely eliminated. It's just that they became a smaller and smaller percentage of the population and eventually became absorbed into the population, which would have been directly ancestral to us.
Well, they like to say that, but I don't think there's actually any concrete proof that just because we have a certain section of our DNA in modern humans today, that another group of humans also have in their DNA. It doesn't mean necessarily that we got it from them. I mean, all DNA is made up of the same letters, isn't it? G, I forget what the letters are, but they're all made up of a similar bit of code that is put together. It's the same letters that go together. So I'm not so certain it's inherited. And though the Cro-Magnons may have been similar to what man is today, he wasn't the same. And we know that blacks in particular, they have a very different DNA that they say that they inherited from one of these groups that were there before that white people don't have. I tend to think that the humans today are, or white people today in particular, are a unique type. And you can compare it to cars. I mean, cars use the same nuts and bolts and wheels and the same structure, but they're all different, and they didn't evolve one from another just because one car has the same system. It has nuts and bolts and the rest of it. It doesn't mean that another car evolved from it. It's just that that's the pattern for all life. It's interesting we have these disagreements here, Max. Both have our different theories here. And obviously Pearson was, he leaned towards what you were saying here. So you've explained what he said here about the climate. He was also known in his lifetime as a prominent free thinker and a socialist. Free thinkers hold that knowledge should be grounded in facts, scientific inquiry and logic. The skeptical application of science implies freedom from the intellectually limiting effects of confirmation bias, cognitive bias, conventional wisdom, popular culture, urban myth, prejudice, or sectarianism. And I would say we try to be like that. We try not to have this confirmation bias, cognitive bias, urban myth, prejudice. You know, we try to look at the facts and the statistics, and we look at the pattern recognition. But so much of that is now considered to be politically incorrect or considered to be taboo, particularly the sort of stuff that Pearson was interested in. He also gave lectures on such issues as the women's question, this being the era of the suffragist movement in the UK, and also upon Karl Marx. So he was very interested in socialism, and his commitment to socialism and its ideals actually led him to refuse the offer of being created an OBE, an Officer of the Order of the British Empire, in 1920, and also to refuse a knighthood in 1935. I do find it interesting that people today, they think that they're free thinkers. And yet when you look here and see what a free thinker actually is, most people today are not free thinkers. They're blinkered thinkers because of this political correctness that we have to go along with all the time. What do you think of these subjects here, Max?
Well, quite a lot of the publications that you can find if you scour the internet the legacy of Karl Pearson, which are very often transcripts of speeches that he made. What you find there is that he very often made speeches to audiences of people who wouldn't necessarily have agreed with what he was saying. And one such speech was one that was made in 1912. It was called the Cavendish Lecture. I don't know whether they still hold the Cavendish Lectures, but they had been held for something like 30 years or so prior to 1912 when Pearson spoke, and the speech he made is entitled Darwinism, Medical Progress and Eugenics, where he spelled out his version of how eugenics should work, pointed to various maladies that people suffered from in those times, and pointed to the fact that because the audience was made up primarily of medical men who would have been involved in alleviating the distress caused by these maladies, but who wouldn't necessarily have been conducting the statistical analysis or conducting these kind of investigations that were necessary to identify the fact that lots of these maladies were genetically determined and were heritable characteristics, and that a lot of these maladies, if a eugenic program was implemented, could be eliminated. And one of the mistakes that people very often make when they consider eugenics is they think that eugenics automatically involves the sterilization of people that have got any kind of sort of genetic malady, or the in extreme cases the murdering of people that have got genetic maladies so that they can't reproduce and so that they won't exist within society. Carl Pearson didn't hold that point of view. He believed that people that had genetic maladies should still reproduce, but that they should limit themselves to a single child. And this is making a speech about eugenics some years back where I made exactly the same point, which is that if you decide that you're going to sterilize people that have got genetic maladies, or if you're going to, in extreme cases, kill them so that they can't reproduce, the point is that you're putting them in a situation where they've got no vested interest in the posterity of society. And if they have no interest in the posterity of society, if they're never going to have any children, then why should they care about the condition of their fellow men, fellow men and women? Why should they care at all? There is no ownership of the eugenic policy on their part. But if you can show that through eugenics and through them limiting the number of children that they have, that it will create a process during which the numbers of people in society that will suffer from that particular malady will gradually reduce, generation after generation, it will reduce and reduce and reduce, and then eventually be eliminated. And that the children that they have, or the child that they have, will pass on their good genes into, albeit that they may have some genes that cause the genetic malady, but they will also be passing on their good genes. And eventually it will only be the genes that cause the genetic malady that will be eliminated. And the good genes that those people possess will go on and will be part of our posterity. And so by having that more enlightened approach to eugenics, you can sell the idea to people on the basis of their own genetic self-interest, and they will see that their children will be part of the posterity and will be better off as a result of them limiting the number of children that they have. So it is a humane and far more acceptable version of eugenics. And it's interesting that as far back as 1912, Carl Pearson was saying this, and yet still, whenever the term eugenics is broached, you get people screaming, people from the left, liberals screaming about how it will all end up in gas chambers. Well, it doesn't have to, and it doesn't need to. And Carl Pearson was a socialist, but he was a national socialist back in 1912, and his version of eugenics didn't involve any harm coming to anybody whatsoever.
That's far more humane than offering rewards for sterilizing people, isn't it? I mean, you can say, well, that's humane. You're offering a reward, but they're still going to be sterilized, and they're still then not going to have a stake in society. Whereas if they just have the one child, obviously you get less and less of these people that have these genetic problems. And that the whole point of it was to be benevolent to people, so that people had a right to be born into a healthy body with a healthy mind. And obviously things have got better since then with medicine. They probably had a lot more people that were born with these genetic deformities back then. But the whole point of eugenics was to improve the health of the nation, to look at the nation as a whole, rather than just looking at the individuals and the individual's needs, but to look at everybody's needs and to try and raise up the conditions so that everybody was more healthy and didn't pass on, you know, these genetic problems. Yeah, that, I hadn't heard that one before. Obviously, I'd heard of positive eugenics, where you offer the rewards, and negative eugenics, when you force people to do things. I guess that would be benevolent eugenics, maybe, or sympathetic eugenics. Can you think of a word for that? Is there a word to describe that particular type of it?
I would think benevolent eugenics would be a suitable title for that approach.
Well, next we have Pearson's views on the Jews. In The Myth of the Jewish Race, Raphael and Jennifer Pate cite Carl Pearson's 1925 opposition, which was in the first issue of the journal Annals of Eugenics, which he founded, his opposition to Jewish immigration into Britain. Pearson alleged that these immigrants will develop into a parasitic race. And he says that, taken on the average and regarding both sexes, this alien Jewish population is somewhat inferior physically and mentally to the native population. And I think there are three interesting things here. Number one, it shows that this was the sort of thing that could be talked about at the time. You could describe another race and say, well, wouldn't they be a bit parasitic if they were to come into our nation? Something that you would definitely have problems with saying today, unless it was very, very carefully contextualized. Secondly, he talks about this alien Jewish population being somewhat inferior physically. And I did a podcast the other week about a Jewish author who was talking about how Jews have managed to succeed in America with gaining influence over the last 100 years. And he made this point himself, that Jews were inferior, or are inferior physically, to the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And they felt that they had to compete with Anglo-Saxon Protestants in a different way. So what he's saying here is actually borne out by Jews today. And thirdly, where he says that they would be inferior mentally to the native population. Now, I don't believe that's true, because with the IQ test, they show that Ashkenazi Jews, there's a particular subset of Ashkenazi Jews that have the highest IQ of all. And Jews are well known for being very intelligent. So where was he getting this idea from, that Jews were mentally inferior to the population? So just three thoughts there on this. What are your thoughts on what he has to say here, Max?
I think using the term parasitic race is the wrong thing to do. I think that one of the things that I've done on Western Spring over the time that we've had our website up, and I've been publishing articles, is to float the idea, and pretty much I've proven that this is a social trend, a social dynamic of what I describe as organized minority advantage. And what you find whenever there is a minority group that migrates into a country where there is an identifiably separate host community, is that minority group will tend to socialize more with their own people, and will tend to work more closely together with their own people, and will adopt an in-group and out-group approach to all of their dealings with other people, where they regard themselves as being an identifiable in-group, where they give preference to people of their own ethnicity, and where they don't offer the same terms, they don't operate in the same way with the host community that they regard as being the out-group. And this happens almost invariably wherever there are minority groups that go. There's an article that written which is called Paradise Island, the Parable, and if people would like to read that, it explains there's a fair bit of maths involved in the article, so it's not for the faint-hearted. But if anybody wants to understand the the mechanism by which an organized minority can become disproportionately wealthy at the expense of a host community. That's that they should read that article, because it sets it all out there with in a way which nobody can actually disagree with. And I think that what's happened with regard to Jewish immigration into Western Europe and to Britain during the early part of the 20th century was that a lot of the Jews concerned came from Eastern Europe, which was racked with all sorts of diseases like TB. And so from that point of view, I think it was identified that a higher proportion of Jewish immigrants into London during the early part of the 20th century had TB compared to the general population. In terms of the mental aspects of things, it has been a principle, I believe, within Jewish societies for men to marry their daughters to rabbis, and rabbis generally have tended to be the most academically able amongst the Jewish community, which is why they have become a rabbi, a teacher. And there has been a tendency over many hundreds of years for wealthy Jews that have become rich as a result of their business dealings to marry their daughters off to rabbis. And so they've had their own eugenic program, which has been orientated around increasing the intelligence of the leadership core within Jewish communities across Europe, that's been very beneficial from the point of view of creating a higher average IQ, I believe, for Jews generally. The price that you pay for that is that there was a certain amount of inbreeding that took place in order to achieve that, and that's part of the reason why I think Jewish communities suffer more from Asperger's syndrome than the population at large. And there are a lot of the doctors who specialize in treating Asperger's syndrome are Jews. And it is a result of the fact that they can see there is a very large amount of Asperger's syndrome in their community. And if you look at select groups from European peoples generally groups that are selected on the basis of their intelligence, what you find is that there is a high level of Asperger's syndrome. If you look at Mensa, which is the society for very intelligent people that exists in this country and also in many other European countries across the world, what you find in Mensa is that the Mensa as an organization exists to be effectively a social club for people who have got very high intelligence, but who also suffer from Asperger's syndrome, which means that they find it very difficult to socialise and to meet partners and to progress in a social sense. Those people who have got very high intelligence and who don't have a problem socialising with other people, they don't need to join Mensa, and so Mensa is effectively a select group of people who, as I say, have got high intelligence, but who've paid quite a heavy price for it in terms of the sense that they've got Asperger's syndrome. And I would suspect that the same factor is at play with regard to Jewish groups, where they have perhaps interbred to too great an extent in order to advance their average intelligence through selective breeding.
So you might get a inferior physique, but a higher intelligence, and you would imagine a small minority would be selecting for intelligence because that is what they would need, whereas a larger group or the host nation would be selecting for physique, so they would end up with a better physique and not so brightly intelligent. I wouldn't describe Jews as a parasitic race at all. I would say that they understand that there is a competition between the races and they are just competing to do the best for their people. I certainly wouldn't describe them as being parasitic. I know authors have done in the past, but I think when you look at it as a competition that's going on, a struggle between different extended kinship groups to advance their cause, and then you can see that there are different ways that these groups advance their cause, and it becomes quite fascinating, actually, the real differences between the races and between the ethnicities, and how over time they have managed to gain influence or managed to progress. And Jews are experts at doing that within multicultural countries, because that's what they've been used to, and we are not used to that. We're used to having monocultural countries, so Jews are doing particularly well at the moment. So it's a shame that he described them as a parasitic race. I doubt very much whether he saw himself as being anti-Semitic. I should imagine he was just using this this analogy there in a scientific way.
But if you look at 19th century India, what you've got there is a very small British minority ruling over a vast swathe of people of the Indian subcontinent, and the part of the reason for them being able to do that was military, but part of the reason also was because there was an in-group, out-group attitude that was employed by the British settlers that went out there. That was then copied by Indians who went to South Africa and other African countries like Uganda, where they set up in business, and they practiced their own in-group, out-group policy there, and to such a point where Idi Amin became enraged about the fact that there were so many successful Indian business people in Uganda, and that they appeared to him to be enriching themselves at the expense of the Uganda people. And so he then expelled the Indians from Uganda, and then we've got the same situation where the Ugandan refugees, lots of them came to Britain, and again, I think as far as the Indian community is concerned, just like any minority group in any country, practiced in-group, out-group preference. And so now we have a number of very successful Indian families in Britain as well. And so rather than trying to claim that any one particular ethnic group or race is particularly bad or evil or parasitic, to use those kind of emotive terms, rather than do that, we should just recognize that all human groups practice in-group, out-group preference. And if we don't like being the victim of the in-group, out-group preference practiced by the immigrant groups that come to Britain, then we need to start practicing an in-group, out-group approach to our dealings with them. And that would then level the playing field.
Definitely need to start practicing more in-group preference and more positive ethnocentrism. Interesting you bring up the Indians there in Uganda, because a similar thing happened with the uprisings in South Africa just recently. They started going after the Indian groups as well. I mean, it's just a natural thing. If you're a minority living amongst a host nation, is you're going to work and you're going to network within your minority, and you're going to keep the money within that group. You're going to go to businesses that are owned by that group. You're going to share the money and loan out money to gain influence. And that's what has happened. We have all these different groups within society now that have got influence, and we've been left behind as white people. We've been resting on our laurels. You know, we thought it was going to be easy. We were going to have our monocultural societies forever, and we don't have a monocultural society anymore. We have a multicultural society, and we've lost our way. We have forgotten that we're in the middle of this competition. These other groups understand it. They understand it very well. We seem to have forgotten, though. Thank you very much for listening, and do tune in again on Monday for part 3 in our mini-series on Carl Pearson.